Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Scientific American's August issue has an article of much interest to us as we go back to school this week. It's titled, The Science of Learning. Researchers are using tools borrowed from medicine and economics to figure out what works best in the classroom, but the results aren't making it into schools. Barbara Kantrowitz is senior editor at the Hechinger Report, a nonprofit news organization founded on education journalism. She wrote the article, and she teaches at Columbia Journalism School, was an editor and writer at Newsweek for more than 20 years, covering education, health, and social issues. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her as we look at this movement that started with No Child Left Behind and has continued under President Obama. What is the new research? What are the widely held beliefs about how we learn? How should teachers be judged about how effective they are? Should you put a lot of pictures and colorful posters in your kindergarten and elementary school classrooms or not? Here's how you can reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. Well, let's start with the way that we imagine at least high school classes and probably most college classes pretty much across the board. You have a really terrific professor, you hope. The professor gets up there, you take notes. The professor you would hope is engaging and very smart, and you get a lecture, and you take your notes, and then you say goodbye. How effective is that, and has that been studied? It's really a primary model for teaching and learning, isn't it?
It is indeed, and most of us did learn that way, but researchers are now beginning to question that style of teaching as well as many others. In the story, I reported on an education scientist at Stanford, Paolo Blickstein, who has done a series of experiments that suggest that it might actually be better for middle and high school students, at least, to kind of play around with some of the problems and then take a lecture, then the lecture might make more sense to them after they've had a chance to experiment with the problem.
And is that true in all subject areas, Barbara?
We don't know that yet. As I point out in the story, this research is still pretty new, and education scientists are learning a little bit more bit by bit, but these kinds of provocative questions that challenge the conventional wisdom about learning, I think, are really a very important first step.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you start with something that you think would be, of course this would be true, that you want a classroom that's colorful, that has a lot of posters in it, and yet you start with Anna Fisher, who's leading this undergraduate seminar on the subject of attention and distractibility in young children, and she noticed that there was a real difference in an ability to learn if you had decorations or if you did not have decorations. Who would have thought about that?
Well, I mean, she didn't really think about it much either, and it actually sort of came to her in a flash when I interviewed her. Anna Fisher, who's a professor at Carnegie Mellon, she told me that she was actually teaching an undergraduate seminar on the subject of attention and distractibility to young children, and she looked around the classroom and she noticed there was nothing on the classroom walls, and that got her thinking about the kindergarten classrooms, which, as we all know, are decorated with all kinds of things, posters and drawings and all kinds of wonderful stuff, which we all think is great and, you know, children love it. But she decided to challenge that little piece of conventional wisdom, and she and one of her graduate students designed an experiment, and they found that actually the kindergartners who learned about a specific subject in a bare classroom were more likely to pay attention and scored higher on comprehension tests than children in decorated classrooms. But Fisher herself cautioned me, this does not mean that kindergarten teachers everywhere should go out and strip the walls of their classrooms.
Right.
What it means is we should maybe think a little more about the environment that children are in when we're trying to teach them something. And maybe certain kinds of decorations are less distracting or, in fact, reinforce the lessons. Other kinds are too much. These are all things that her experiment these are questions her experiment didn't answer, but it's really good leads for future research.
So tell me, how extensive, when did we start bringing rigorous science to U.S. classrooms? How extensive are all of the studies that look at how we learn best, what's most effective?
Well, the U.S. public education, we won't even talk about other kinds of K through 12 education, but public education is a vast ecosystem, and it's very, very difficult to have wholesale changes. Right now, I'm sure most of your listeners have heard of the Common Core, and that was an attempt to bring some kind of standardization and to raise standards in all classrooms. That's going very slowly. So we would not expect this new research to be immediately applied in every classroom across the country. And also, much of the research now is what I would describe as still in the early stages. It doesn't answer every question about a type of learning or a curriculum, but what it does, and I think this is very important, is present the idea that curriculum and styles of learning, of teaching, should be subject to research and should be tested in the way that other kinds of tools are tested. One of the metaphors that these scientists often use is that we should test teaching the way we test drugs. And there are problems with that metaphor, but the basic idea is we should not do something until we know that it works.
Yeah. Well, what are we thinking about how we test teachers? Because that's such a, if you ask me, it's the key to education, are really great teachers. And a lot of people will say, well, you know it when you see it. You know it when you're in the classroom. Can you do scientific studies? And if so, what are they to determine whether a teacher is great or not?
Well, I think that is an incredibly controversial area right now. There are people who think that the best way to test teachers is to see if in a year a teacher raises the test scores of the children in her class. Many other people say that's way too simplistic and doesn't really tell you very much. In other countries, one of the ways that teachers are evaluated is through a combination of means. A very important part of that is observation by experienced master teachers and educators who do know what to look for. Are the students engaged? Do they ask questions? Is the teacher in charge of the classroom? Is she presenting the right amount of material? Those are all things that I personally believe observation is probably a better mm-hmm. way of assessing that. But there is some combination of testing how much students learn and observation that probably could tell us. I don't think right now that there is a consensus on the best way to evaluate a teacher.
Mm-hmm. What about the size of a classroom? I thought this was an interesting part of your article. Classroom size is not always paramount. Really, that goes counter to our wisdom, common wisdom about this.
Yes, and this is something that, again, almost every area in education that you can think of has some controversy attached to it. But for a long time, people thought, especially for low-income children, the best way to improve their learning was to reduce the size of the classrooms. But one of the scientists that I wrote about found that actually summer school could be a more cost-effective way of raising test scores than reducing class sizes. There's a lot of problems with simply saying class sizes must be small. Do you get enough good teachers to teach all those smaller classes? What do the teachers teach? It's not a simple matter of just simply making 16 students in a class and that's it. Mm-hmm. You have to do much more.
So tell me, who is studying what is most effective? When we look at scientific research in this whole area, who is studying teaching?
Many people are studying teaching. One of the interesting things is, in maybe 20 years ago, a lot of this research would have been centered around schools of education, and it was kind of in a silo. That isn't totally true, but it was largely true. Now, scientists and researchers from many other disciplines are looking at teaching and learning. You have neuroscientists, you have cognitive psychologists, you have people just from all different fields and even economists. And in many cases, they're working kind of in an interdisciplinary way, so they're not just doing their little part of it. They're working with people who have other kinds of expertise, and they're joining together to see, can their combined expertise produce a more complete picture of what works and what doesn't.
And they're actually, what, videotaping students, and I would imagine teachers as well, and they're using skin sensors? What do those measure?
Well, what's really great about the fact that there is an increased amount of government funding and there are new tools, and what you mentioned are some of the new tools that are available. They don't just videotape students or teachers. You videotape them, and then you look for certain facial expressions or eye movements or hand movements that we know have a significance, and that you can attach sensors to the skin that measure the level of excitement or anxiety, different kinds of emotions. Another really great new tool is data mining. We can track students over a period of time and see what kinds of things work and don't work. That was something that large-scale data mining was just not available even 10 years ago. So these are all new tools combined with new sources of funding and a feeling that we really have to get science-based learning and teaching into the classroom that I think should make all of us hopeful.
And yet the problem is getting it into the classroom, right?
Right. And here, you know, I part of me is very sympathetic to teachers who in the last 10 or 15 years really have been battered and made to feel like they just have no voice in the process. In many school districts, teachers get one curriculum and they're told this is the answer. Then they get another curriculum that completely reverses it. And teachers feel frustrated, and I think they also feel, teachers and administrators, not just teachers, but they kind of feel like, hey, we've got expertise too. We're here in the classroom. We're actually watching students day in and day out. So I think there is a certain level of suspicion about some of this new research. And I was encouraged because I interviewed a number of people who were involving classroom teachers and other educators in the research design process and in the experiments themselves, and I think that kind of collaboration is also really helpful.
Now, you talk about the What Works Clearinghouse. Is this a government organization, and they've got all these studies on file somewhere?
That's right. They're not all of the studies that I'm talking about. They are studies funded by certain branches of the government, and this is what really this is what got started in 2002, just after No Child Left Behind took effect, in which school districts were required in order to get federal money to have curricula that was based on research. And there just wasn't any way for them to find out if this curricula was based on research, if it was scientifically proven effective.
Mm-hmm.
So the government started the Institute for Education Sciences, and that produced the What Works Clearinghouse. And there's a lot in there that it can be very useful, but it's hardly complete, even though it has hundreds of reports that summarize findings on topics such as math instruction, elementary school writing, and other things, but it doesn't review everything. And right now, a lot of districts are looking for material that's aligned with the Common Core, and they can't just go into the What Works Clearinghouse and type in Common Core and get the right curricula, because it's just not organized that way, and not every curricula is tested.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll do that in just one moment. Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655. Barbara Kantoritz is our guest. Barbara is an award-winning former Newsweek senior editor. She writes about health, education, and social issues, and she has a very interesting piece in the current issue. Well, it's not current. It's August. It's still August. It's just a couple days past, right? It's an article that's titled "The Science of Learning: Researchers Are Using Tools Borrowed from Medicine and Economics to Figure Out What Works Best in the Classroom, but the results aren't making it into the schools." So Barbara looked at several studies that looked at what works best in the classroom, particularly in science classrooms and in math classrooms. What's the most effective method of teaching? What about summer school? What about smaller class sizes? We've yet to talk about what about high poverty schools? What is research saying about that? Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. We're also on Facebook at the Kathleen Dunn Show. As we go back to school this week, what's the best classroom? What's the best way of teaching? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. We have many of them. Jeanette is our first caller in Rusk County. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, thank you for taking my call and letting me share my opinion. When I heard 16 kids to a glass room, I was absolutely speechless. Granted, it's been a few years since I was in school, but when I was in K-12, it was 30 kids, 31, 32 kids. And when it comes to the basics, can I read? Can I write? Do I know how to do arithmetic? I have an excellent education that I will match up against anybody. Technology, no, because that's not my field or my interest. So I haven't pursued a lot of hard sciences in physics and math and that sort of thing. It's not about classroom size. It's about how good are our teachers, but also how supportive are parents, how dedicated are they and their children to the educational process. If they want to learn, they'll learn. If they don't want to learn, our teachers are really, I mean, they're up against the wall with some kids. And I will listen to what the response is off my radio.
All right, Jeanette. Yeah, thanks for the call. Barbara.
Well, I don't think anybody would disagree that excellent teachers and supportive parents are critical. It's very hard for children to learn without those two components. As I said earlier, class size isn't the only thing that affects the quality of learning in a classroom. I do think, though, that having supportive parents, good teachers, doesn't automatically mean kids will learn. Some kids have learning issues. Sometimes teachers don't have the best, are told to teach a curriculum, or they don't have the best training to teach certain subjects. So it's not quite that simple, but you definitely have to build on the foundation of excellent, caring teachers and supportive parents.
You see, this thing about not having a large classroom size, I don't know, you could do 50 million studies, and I still would question them, Barbara, because, you know, if you're a teacher and you've got a long essay from 32 students or from 16 students, who's going to get more attention? Who's going to get more advice? Who's going to get more thorough reading? It's very, very hard to be a good teacher with that many students in the classroom.
That's true. I mean, as a general statement, that I think most people would agree with you, but what the study I cited was looking at something very specific. How should schools spend federal money that's supposed to go toward low-income students? And, you know, that schools have to make choices. And in this study, the Cornell economist who studied this problem found that students who had gone to summer school were doing just a little bit better than, you know, were doing better just because of going to summer school. So maybe summer school would be a more cost-effective way of raising test scores. Now, it could also be that if you took those students who'd had summer school and then put them in smaller classes, they would do even better. But this particular study was meant to be a guide to districts who have to make tough choices.
Mm-hmm. Jack is next in Viola. Hi. Jack?
Hello?
Hi, Jack.
Yeah, this is Jack. Thanks for taking my call. Two quick comments, well, sort of. I'm a clinical social worker, and evidence base has been really big in our field, which is what they're talking about in education. But there's a limitation to evidence because cognitive behavioral doesn't get at the whole picture, which is the emotional relationship that you have with your students or your clients and helping them develop as human beings. And as when I was started way back in college, you know, 30 years ago, it was so important about psychology was, you know, part science and part art, and the same thing as with teaching. And teaching, well, I hear all about the science and math, but I don't hear anything about the psychology and the art that goes along to eliciting the type of education. Great. Give you an example. You know, you can have all the math and science you want. You can build atomic weapon. You can do a lot of things with science. But where's the wisdom to learn how to use technology in a correct way, in a sustainable way? You know, this is what I'm concerned about when they talk about science and math and, you know, teaching. Yes, do evidence-based. But yes, understand there is the art and focus on the art of teaching and what that means psychologically besides cognitive behavioral, because that's only 50% of the whole thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack, for your call. Barbara?
I think that that's a really excellent point, and it's a main point of discussion in the education research community right now. Can you decide what works just based on the randomized controlled trial kind of experiment that drug companies use to test whether a drug works or not? And many people would say, no, you can't, because there is another component to deciding whether something works, and that's, you know, you observe a teacher who's a very good teacher, a master teacher, and, you know, you see how well she connects with students. I personally believe that teaching is both an art and a science. I think there are things you can learn that will help you be a better teacher. You can learn these from other people or maybe mentor teachers who are guiding you. But part of it has to come from you and the kind of relationships you build with your students. I teach graduate students myself, and I speak from personal experience when I say that I could get all the training in pedagogy in the world, but if I don't really connect with each student, it's not going to be any good to me.
Mm-hmm. And how do you go about doing that?
That's the art part. It's different for every.
Right.
It's a relationship, student-teacher relationship. You kind of have to understand where each student is, how they learn best, and what you can do to help them improve.
We go to David in Door County next.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi. I guess my question or comment sort of piggybacks on your last caller. Listening to this, I'm thinking about the sort of millennia of history that we've got, showing that teaching has long been a philosophical endeavor. And so I guess I was kind of wondering how you would balance the new emphasis on research and scientific tools with the long history going back maybe to Plato and even beyond, the philosophical history of teaching. And I'll take my question off
here.
Thank
you, David. Thanks.
I think this caller and the previous one are correct in saying you shouldn't throw out all the good stuff we know just because we have new ways of testing curricula. But I think you can do both. I think you can use this new science to help teachers who already have a deep understanding of what it takes to learn. I think teachers, if they understood what the new science was trying to do, would actually be grateful for it. It doesn't mean that we are disregarding everything they know and feel and have learned. We're trying to help them be even better.
This is an interesting study, and they're probably not a whole lot of math and science teachers who do this. I'm sure there are many who do, but I found this to be an interesting study that the science is showing that you try something, it doesn't work, you reevaluate what you're doing, you go back, you try it again, you fail. You may fail, but you can learn from your failing, and that's a different model than what we usually have, which is here's how you do something, follow the rules, and then you'll get it.
Well, it's interesting because, especially in teaching science, scientists themselves, they don't, you know, how is science working? You have an idea, you test it, it works or it doesn't work. If it doesn't work, if your theory is not correct, then you try to find out why and you move on to the next step. And often when you teach science, or at least I can remember when I was learning science, it was not so experimental and it didn't really mimic the actual practice of science, which is much more creative than I think non-scientists believe.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jackie next in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I guess I totally agree with a lot of what she's saying. I think technology should definitely be incorporated in the classroom. I've taught math and science myself. But I think some people fail to recognize a lot of the outside components that lead up to everyday teaching in the classroom. For example, I taught down south. I've taught in several different states. And one of the schools was in Florida. I think people forget that teaching is unlike any other profession in the sense that, for example, my father's a construction worker. If he gets a bad board sent to him, he can send that back to the store and say, hey, this isn't going to work for building my building. I need a different one. As teachers, we don't get to do that. I was getting children in my classroom whose basic needs were not met, and it is very, very challenging to teach someone when they are extremely tired, when they are hungry, when they haven't been fed, when they haven't been able to bathe themselves because they don't have their basic needs met. And on top of that, there was a language barrier from where I was at. I would have students in the classroom whose first language was Spanish. We called them off the boaters. They literally came. They don't know any English. And I would have to set them next to a student that I thought was, you know, bilingual to some degree. I would teach 10 minutes of math. And then I would look at them and say, hey, could you please translate this to the child next to you? And they could be talking about their weekend. I didn't know a lick of Spanish. Spanish is not my second language. And then these children were expected to say, take the exact same national test as every other student throughout the United States. And that was rather frustrating when the results reflected on who I was as a teacher, when I think people forget that sometimes, like I said, the basic needs of the students aren't being met in the first place. So I think we have other places we might need to look as well.
Again, I couldn't agree more with that. I think those issues are critically important. And often when you hear sort of talking heads on TV bashing teachers, I sort of want to say, you go and spend a week
Absolutely.
In a classroom with one of those teachers, and
right.
you tell me who's to blame here or what the problem is. I think too many people who criticize teachers haven't actually been in public schools, and they don't understand what teachers face.
Yeah. You mentioned, and Jackie brings up an interesting point, that we have these classrooms that have people with maybe who don't speak English as the first language, who have didn't have breakfast or weren't able to sleep, or they've moved a lot in the last year. You talk about, and we frequently bring up on this show as well, the model of Finland at the end of your article, the country rebuilding its education system and rising to the top of international math and literacy rankings. Some ways, comparison, you write, to American schools is unfair because Finland is a more homogenous country. So my question to you is, do all of these studies have to take that into account? And if so, how do they do that? The fact that you've got the kinds of life experiences that Jackie was describing in the classroom.
Of course they do. And I think that that some of these experiments could focus on children with specific needs, like the children she's describing. But what the overall picture, it's not so much that describing one particular experiment or another. It's the overall idea that what the kind of tools we use in the classroom, we should have some evidence before we use them that they're actually going to work, whether it's on all students or a particular group of students or only for a particular problem. We shouldn't just be buying things or imposing things on teachers and students without knowing whether they're the best we could give them.
Let's go next to Sue and thank you, Jackie, for your call. Sue and Eau Claire. Hi, Sue.
Yes, hello. I agree with many things people have said. I am a former teacher, and I would like to say that still the research, people go back and forth over it, is still class size is extremely important, one of the most important aspects of teaching. But one thing that's always concerned me is the federal government's way of identifying students with problems, reading problems, disabilities, and they create a second class of learners because by the time they're identified at 1+ years deficit, you know, they're already way behind and they just stay there.
So is your question is, I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly understand. I would say that class size, I don't mean for my description in the story to imply that class size doesn't matter. This was one specific experiment about whether summer school, how effective summer school was, and the researcher felt that, you know, if a district has to make a tough choice about how to spend money, maybe summer school is a better way to spend money than reducing class size. I think most teachers would prefer to teach a smaller group of students, but we're facing some harsh realities in public education right now, and sometimes teachers have to have larger classes. The question is, how do you decide how to spend the money? Is it more important to provide summer school, or is it more important to provide class size? Those are the kinds of questions that education scientists can help decide.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sue, for your call. In terms of who's asking for the studies, where the studies are being generated, is it coming from educators, from principals, from teachers, or is it coming from policymakers and people who are into technology and scientists, and they're figuring out what the problems might be, or is it coming bottom up?
It's coming from everywhere. There isn't one source. I think that there's different kinds of studies. Studies funded by the government by the Institute of Education Scientists tend to want to look at curriculum and teaching methods that are effective. The National Science Foundation funds studies that look at the best math and science curricula. Other people, technology companies, are looking at ways that these are maybe privately funded studies, looking at ways that technology can aid learning. All kinds of people are interested in the science of learning right now, and the funding comes from everywhere. And often the questions, to be honest, are based on what the funders say is their priority.
Mm-hmm. Joy in Madison, hello.
Hi. I just finished reading a really interesting book called The Y Axis. That's the H-Y, the Y Axis, not Y, the letter Y Axis. And they're behavioral economists, and they did a study in Chicago of they went to a very, very disadvantaged school area in South Chicago. And they one of the experiments they set up was motivating the students to retake standardized exams, and they gave them $20 or $50 to try and do better.
Hmm.
And they found that those students, in many cases, came within several points of the scores of students from very high-income suburban school districts. And then they had other alternatives where they gave monetary incentives to the parents and to the teachers. So I think that's something really worth checking out, because they seem to have some very good luck with it.
So what did the students do? Were they spending more time after school studying the material?
No. They just had a reason to excel. They had the monetary reason to excel. Huh. I guess they had no other real motivation that made them want to do well on the test, because it was, I don't know whether it's a societal issue or what, but they didn't do anything other than that, as far as I recall.
Interesting.
They just performed better.
Yeah, Barbara.
Well, I'm not familiar with that book, that particular study. I have read about other studies in which students get monetary incentive. I think that has limited success, as I understand it. It's also, I'm a little confused that the students were able to do well whether beforehand, but they didn't for some reason. Most students want to do well. So just giving them the money, there must have been some other kind of intervention that went on, it seems to me, other than just giving them money. They didn't have any practice tests, or they didn't learn more. It's sort of hard to believe. But again, I haven't read it, so I don't really know.
Yeah.
You find it interesting. It's a good read. So
yeah.
You.
What? And give me the name again.
The Y, W-H-Y, the Y axis.
W-H-Y.
As opposed to X and Y axis, it's the Y axis. And
right.
It's John List and Uri Queasy.
Okay. We'll look it up. It sounds interesting.
Thank
you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Joy. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the science of learning on this day when so many go back to school. And our guest has written a piece in Scientific American. Barbara Kantrowitz is with us, and we're talking about that piece. It's the science of learning and the tools that researchers have borrowed from medicine and economics to figure out what works best in the classroom. But sometimes the results are not making it into the classroom, so we have yet to talk more about why that's the case. It looks at some very interesting experiments and new research that has challenged widely held beliefs. And so that's what we're discussing. And getting a lot of phone calls. Lines are finally open after all this time. So if you've been wanting to speak with us, now would be the time for you to call. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. We have a couple of those. We'll get to them in a moment. And the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to some emails that have come in. Blair on Facebook says this, Barbara, teachers bring so much expertise, and our potential as researchers is severely untapped. In Oakland, Mills Teacher Scholars is training and supporting teachers to do inquiry-based research in our own classrooms. When we do the research and participate in the research, we are able to enter the conversation about what works in a meaningful way and have an informed say in education policy, not to mention training teachers as teacher researchers will combat teacher burnout.
I think that's absolutely correct, and that was one of the main things I got from my reporting on this story, is that teachers must be part of the process or there's almost no point to it, and teachers have a huge amount to contribute. I personally always feel teachers are heroes, and we should treat them that way, but they're also experts, and we need to take advantage of their expertise. I think that education scientists are really beginning to understand that they want teachers to be part of the process. It's just much better. The results are much better and more useful when teachers are involved.
Yeah. David in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the least qualified guy in the room, but I did teach abroad for several years. And I sort of, over the course of time, developed a mantra, a three-word mantra, which sort of guided everything I said after that, which is confidence is key. And that was sort of how I would like to have been taught, you know. And so I guided my students through the Socratic method, you know. I ask questions. I sort of believe that you don't just apply an answer. You get a group consensus and guide the group through all that sort of, yeah, whatever that is, brilliant imagination to arrive at an answer, and you drive towards that. And I think that in classrooms, it's important for teachers to not be pedantic or punitive, you know, to not consider themselves in that way, and to take into consideration the limited attention span of children and create a frenetic classroom environment in which you keep moving around and doing different things in order to foster and encourage that sort of self-discovery, which I think is ultimately the long-term goal of learning.
Were you successful?
I think so. It took me a while to get the hang of it, but
mm-hmm.
Because that was not the model that I was brought up with here in the U.S., the model I was brought up with in the U.S. was you learn by rote, you know. But what I discovered in a foreign language environment was the importance of, you know, okay, I'm going to put two sentences up on the board. What do you like better? And why? What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Barbara?
Well, I don't know what country you were in, but it sounds like you were a great teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I do think the problem is broader than a single teacher's experience. Teachers in this country right now have so many pressures on them. They're required to have their students reach specific goals. They don't always know the best way for those students to reach those learning goals. The administrators have to choose between huge numbers of curricula. They don't know which one is the best one to reach those goals. There are all kinds of pressures that public schools in this country have to deal with. And I think that a more scientific approach to helping administrators and teachers understand what works, why it works, what's the best way to teach a certain subject, I think that can be extremely helpful. I don't think anybody believes anymore that rote learning is the only way to learn. I think we've gone beyond that, fortunately. But there's still many other questions that have to be answered when you're in a public school classroom.
I don't know. I still would like to memorize poetry.
Well, I don't know if that doesn't qualify as rote learning. When I hear the phrase rote learning, what I always remember is in chemistry in high school, I had to memorize the periodic table,
uh-huh.
And I have no idea how those elements interacted or what it was for or anything. You know, maybe they still do that, but that turned me off chemistry, unfortunately.
Yeah, but it does you well when you watch Jeopardy, and doesn't it? It really does. They ask that a lot.
Yeah.
Fran has an email. She has not heard anything regarding leadership in our schools creating the appropriate appropriate environment for teachers and students. I've been to too many schools, she writes, where the leadership has either limited or no knowledge about what works. They are managers of buildings, especially in our urban schools.
Well, I mean, that's a criticism I've heard. It's not something that any of the research I reported on addressed, but there certainly is a desperate need for education leaders who not only can be good managers, but also good educators and can help guide the teachers in their schools. That's terribly important.
Thank you, David, so much for your call. We go to Dusty in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. I just called because I'm a newly retired special education teacher of 33 years, and I have been kind of watching summer school, in my opinion, deteriorate over time. The special ed kids always are, you know, put in, to me, productive classes. But then there's the other kids that get to do the fun things like cooking and sewing and things like that. And I just think there's a better way for our educational money to be spent, something more academic, I guess, is what I'm focusing on.
And what about summer school just as an institution? Did you find that it was very helpful for students, Dusty?
Yes.
Because?
The school, such as, you mean during summer school?
Mm-hmm.
For the special ed students, I thought that was very helpful. And my son's always taken academic related classes, and he's considered gifted, but loved it, and still continued to make gains.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's why I just am an advocate more for, you know, more academically based classes mm-hmm. than the fun course.
Barbara.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about summer school is it extends the school year, and there are a lot of people who believe that that would be a good thing for many students, whether they're special education students or standard track students. Experienced teachers know that if students have been off for 2 or 3 months, when they come back in September, they've lost some ground, and you often have to spend the first couple of weeks of school just getting them back up to speed. So I think well-run summer school can be a good thing. Summer school is also not just academic. I'm not sure exactly what kind of summer school the caller observed, but sometimes kids need, especially in urban areas, need safe places to be in the summer, and sometimes even that is helpful to them just because it keeps them in a safe environment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dusty, for your call. Let's move on to Dan in Merrimack.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My daughter for 11 years was a teacher. The last 8 years she taught in Milwaukee School District. She had 4 classes this last year that she taught. She had 168 students.
Ooh.
So if you do the math, you notice that she's got her largest class had 47 students in it.
Oh, it's too many.
And I'm just curious as to how, for these kids to go to summer school, how is that going to reduce the class size or the ability to continue teaching these students in a manner that is going to help them in their the rest of their school career?
I don't think that summer school is the answer. The experiment that I described simply was trying to guide educators in low-income areas who have federal money that they can spend in a number of ways. One way would be to try and reduce class size. Another way would be to provide summer school. And this particular experiment suggested that summer school might be cost-effective because simply reducing class size by itself doesn't necessarily improve test scores. But I think a class of 47 students in an urban area, especially if the students have lots of needs.
Oh,
it sounds too big to me.
Yeah, me too. Way, way, way too big.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dan, very much for your call. We started the hour talking about attention and distractibility in young children. I'm wondering, Barbara, if there have been some scientific studies, because we hear so much that we're impairing our young people's ability to concentrate on anything because they have to concentrate on so much, flipping to this, to that, can't be with anything for more than a minute. Has anybody done studies on whether or not our middle school students and our high school students are too easily distracted?
Well, there is a lot of ongoing research on the effect of ever-present media on developing minds. I don't know off the top of my head, you know, if there are any overall conclusions, but I think it's clear. Many teachers know that, or many teachers say anecdotally that they feel their students over the years, the attention spans are shorter and shorter, and that's not a good thing. What concerns me as someone who's covered education for a long time is how often younger children are put in front of electronic media rather than learning to develop the mental tools to amuse themselves and learn themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what the brain is supposed to do in the early years, is kind of learn to amuse yourself and learn things on your own with your hands and your eyes and your body rather than just being in front of a screen, even with the best TV shows, you know, geared for children.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, you know, as the children get older, they haven't developed that kind of skills when they're little, and it makes it even harder as they get older.
And I can't remember what study this was, but it caught my interest in your article. Gaming, what was the study? It had to do with gaming easy problems or versus gaming harder problems.
This was part of a study using data mining, which is tracking large amounts of data. And the education researcher I spoke to had been tracking students from middle school through college, and the students, when they were in middle school, used a web-based math tutoring program. And because there's so much information when they use this program, they can see how much time students spent on harder problems, how much they spent on easier problems. And what they found was that students who tried to get through a particular set of problems without following all the steps, which is gaming the system, was the gaming the easier problems was not as harmful as gaming the harder problems. So students who game the easier problems might understand the process behind finding the answer already, and they just didn't want to follow all the steps. But students who tried to guess at the harder problems didn't really understand the material. So this is the kind of information that if the teacher knew at the time that the students were doing this program to watch out for students who are gaming the harder problems, then maybe they could step in and say, hey, what is it you don't understand?
Right. Another message on Facebook. This is congratulations to Montessori. One word, Liz writes, Montessori. Over 100 years ago, Dr. Montessori followed the children, learned from the children, and built the classroom around the children. Montessori parents and teachers band together to buck the flavors of the day curriculum adoptions in order to protect our class communities and our Montessori methodology.
I'm not an expert on Montessori. It wasn't in my reporting for this story, so I don't know.
So what is the best way, we have about a minute left now, to make sure that the best of these scientific studies find their way into classrooms? How can that be achieved?
I really think there has to be a greater spirit of cooperation between the research community and teachers, and both sides have to understand that they have the same goal, which is to improve learning for all our kids, and they have to work together. And each side has a kind of expertise that is important to the other side.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Barbara, for being with us. It was really an interesting article and lots of interest in the topic.
Well, it's great. I'm glad to see people care about our public schools.
Yeah, I am too. Our guest this hour has written a story that's in the August issue of Scientific America, the one that has the black hole at the beginning of time on the cover of it. It's an article that is titled The Science of Learning. Researchers are using tools borrowed from medicine and economics to figure out what works best in the classroom, but the results are not making it into schools. Barbara Kantrowitz is senior editor at the Hechinger Report, a nonprofit news organization that focuses on education journalism. She teaches at Columbia Journalism school and was an editor and writer at Newsweek for a number of years. We thank her for her time. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about kind of on this education bent this week because everybody's going back to school. So we're going to be talking about teaching history tomorrow. And we'll also be looking the second hour of the show at this really interesting exhibit that's at the Milwaukee Art Museum, Postcards from America. It's the first museum exhibition of photographs from the Postcards from America project. And it's got some amazing pictures of Milwaukee and surrounding communities. So that's coming up on our program tomorrow. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP for doing our on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thank you for listening. News is coming up and great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.